Production support for Earth Eats comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
There are ways that we can think about changing our perspective and using our daily rituals of thanks and gratitude to start investigating the land on which we find ourselves.
Raj Patel is the author of the books Stuffed and Starved and The Value of Nothing. He's also a contributor to a book of letters to young farmers. He talks to us today about the problematic concept of owning land. Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Some rural advocates worry that their areas will be overlooked by the Trump administration. Arbus Public Media tells us about the USDA restructuring that's at the root of their concerns. And then it's watermelon. Two Ways with Chef Daniel Orr. What's up in food news? Mark Chilla.
This week, the FDA delayed the deadline for food companies to adopt a new nutrition facts label. The rule would have required a line on food and beverage packages indicating added sugars, and it would have listed calories in big, bold text. A design for the new label was unveiled by Michelle Obama in 2014 at a White House event held on the anniversary of her campaign to fight obesity. Originally, large companies had been given until July 2018 to comply with the new label. The Trump administration has also delayed the deadline for complying with a rule that requires chain restaurants to post calories. The Washington Post reported in May that a shipment of 36 million pounds of ordinary soybeans sprayed with pesticides before and during their journey from Ukraine and Turkey suddenly became organic when they reached the port of Stockton, California. The added USDA organic label increased the soybeans' value by $4 million. The Post also reported on two similar prior incidents, both involving millions of pounds of corn or soybeans shipped to the U.S. from Turkey. The shipments represent about 7% of annual organic corn imports and 4% of organic soybean imports to the U.S. USDA officials say they're investigating the matter, but declined to identify any of the firms or shipments involved. Enter the organic food industry, specifically the Organic Trade Association, which is taking matters into its own hands by developing the task force and methods for companies to ensure organic imports are what they claim to be. But some U.S. farmers are skeptical. They say they've been waiting for years for the industry to take fraudulent organics seriously, and that the task force must go beyond just developing best practices. While most food labeled USDA organic is grown in the U.S., at least half of some organic commodities, from corn and soybeans to coffee, come from as many as 100 countries. And you have a late-night hankering for pickles. Quick, where's the first place you think to go? Well, the owners of German grocery chain Aldi know it's likely not there. But they're hoping to change that, with 800 new stores and an additional $5 billion in investments. Their goal over the next 3 years is to become the third largest grocery chain in the U.S., behind only Walmart and Kroger. Similar German chain Lidl opens its first stores later this week on the East Coast. The company plans to open at least 200 stores in the coming years. Both Aldi and Lidl offer a limited selection of deeply discounted store brand food items that reflects a successful trend in grocery store models, while the industry as a whole struggles with lower prices and shrinking earnings. And I want to draw your attention to a story about grocery stores in Indiana. The grocery chain Marsh filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy in May. Some of the stores are now being bought up by Kroger. But it's being reported that other locations in rural parts of the state will close their doors. Go to eartheats.org for this story and plenty of other food and farming stories.
Mark, see you next week.
See you then.
President Donald Trump has pledged to revive rural communities where many voters have felt ignored by previous administrations. But recent actions are raising questions about whether the White House is committed to that goal. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports.
You know the Department of Agriculture deals with farmers and ranchers. What you might not know is how much the Ag Department works on other stuff, working to grow the broader rural economy through the Office of Rural Development. But after just a few weeks on the job, Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue is shaking things up at USDA.
Mr. Secretary, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Chairman Conaway, and thank you, ranking member.
As part of an agency-wide reorganization, Perdue now plans to eliminate the USDA's Undersecretary for Rural Development. Instead, rural development efforts would be run by an assistant reporting to the Ag Secretary. Perdue told the House Ag Committee he considers it a promotion.
That person's going to be sitting close to me with walk-in privileges over, this is a great opportunity, this is the deal, what do you think about it, how can we do better? The mission is not going to diminish whatsoever.
It is very clearly a demotion for rural development.
That's Ferd Hefner of the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition. Hefner says the undersecretaries at USDA are like the president's cabinet. When big decisions are made on policy or the budget, undersecretaries are in the room. He says assistants typically are not. So when it comes to making important choices at USDA,
food safety will be there and farm programs will be there and all the other undersecretaries will be there and rural development won't have a spot.
Rural development programs provide funding to finance businesses, update utilities, and build infrastructure. Critics like Hefner worry that without an undersecretary, there will be less attention on small towns that depend on that government support. That includes cities like Syracuse in southeast Nebraska, population 2,000. Community Memorial Hospital in Syracuse was built in 1952. The emergency room is too small, and CEO Michael Harvey says the design doesn't fit the walk-in, walk-out procedures of modern healthcare.
90% of what we do is on an outpatient basis. Our current facility was not designed for that.
So they're putting up a new hospital, moving away from the old building, here to the edge of town, across from the truck stop and next to the tractor dealership. There would be a shiny, state-of-the-art hospital here, with a bigger ER and a bigger operating room. Harvey says small rural hospitals have to keep up if they want to stay open, but many can't afford to finance the updates without help from the federal government.
We were able to get a $25 million loan for the facility with a 40-year term and a very low interest rate.
Harvey says commercial banks don't offer big 40-year loans to small hospitals, but the USDA does through Rural Development's Community Facilities Direct Loan Program. Last year, that program lent $2.2 billion for 656 projects nationwide, everything from health clinics to libraries to fire departments. 80 rural hospitals have closed nationwide since 2010. But in Syracuse, the doors will stay open for rural patients and local workers.
We're probably the second or third largest employer in town next to the school system.
Many of USDA's rural development programs are aimed at creating jobs from small businesses and services like medicine and tourism. USDA Secretary Sonny Perdue says that won't change. But the Trump administration's recent budget proposal would make changes. The plan would cut more than $4 billion from USDA's discretionary budget. That includes eliminating a program that rebuilds small-town water systems and another aimed at creating small businesses. Jonathan Hladek at the Center for Rural Affairs says that undercuts the idea that removing the Undersecretary for Rural Development amounts to a promotion.
It's difficult to, on one side, say that this is going to be an elevation of rural development, but on the other side, the only other action you've taken has been to eliminate the budget dramatically.
The budget, of course, is just a proposal. Congress is likely to ignore many of the cuts. Meanwhile, Secretary Perdue can move ahead to reorganize rural development on his own. He told lawmakers to judge him by the results. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
All the Harvest reporters post stories at harvestpublicmedia.org. Raj Patel is an academic and a researcher at the University of Texas at Austin, but his contribution to Letters to a Young Farmer feels like a poem in places. It's beautiful writing, and it's potent. There are lines like this: "Before white people came to this land, it belonged to no one, for there was no property in land before conquest." In fact, he took inspiration from Rainer Maria Rilke's letters to a young poet as he was crafting his message. Earth Eats' Megan Betts spoke with Raj Patel over Skype several months ago. They talked about land rights and the commons.
So I have to say, your essay in Letters to a Young Farmer was the most powerful essay for me personally, and just for me as a food studies scholar. So could you start by saying what you brought into that essay? What were you thinking? What made you feel like that was the essay you needed to write?
Well, you're very kind, Megan. I mean, I think it's important in this moment in world history for us to be able to take a step back and take the long view, particularly when we're prompted by movements like the actions against the Dakota Access Pipeline, for example. The history of the United States is a history of genocide, and it's often believed that, oh well, you know, that obviously that's very sad, but now all the indigenous people have gone, and we might as well do the best with the land as we can. And of course, indigenous people are still alive despite the best efforts of the federal government and contemporary historians to write them out. And the fights like the one in the Dakota Access Pipeline are a reminder that there's resurgence and power in indigenous people's work and communities that needs to be respected. And at the time I was writing this, I was working with a number of indigenous activists and scholars around issues of food. And it seemed to me that the bridge between land farming and what America used to be before it was settled were ideas that could probably do with being brought out in a way that holds all of us accountable. So that's what I was hoping to do with this with the short letter.
So in the letter, you urge farmers not only to farm, but to unearth the history of colonization, of exploitation in our food systems. So how can farmers, or any of those listening, go about doing that work?
Part of what I'm hoping is, you know, for myself as much as everyone else, that we can change the way we move in the world to recognize that the practice of understanding what's beneath our feet is a practice we need to remember daily. So that may sound very abstract. For example, if you go to Canada, large parts of Canada, if you're ever in a room where someone's giving a lecture, or when someone is just welcoming you to someplace, it is part of the rituals of welcome that one, you know, not only welcomes the invited guest, but also thanks the indigenous people on whose land the reception is being held. So it's something that you can build into the way one thinks about oneself and one's place in the world. And there are ways that we can think about changing our perspective and using our daily rituals of thanks and gratitude to start investigating the land on which we find ourselves. I'm starting to think quite a lot about indigenous people's relationship to the land historically and in a contemporary way. And understanding that can also help us understand the future. So this isn't, basically what I'm not trying to do is guilt trip anyone, because guilt isn't a very productive emotion. But anger and a certain kind of rage against past injustice, and also an understanding of what needed to be transformed for the injustices to be carried out. Well, that can be helpful, because if you understand how people used to live on the land and the kinds of relationships that people had with nature, we can try and reinvent those. We're not going to reenact them, but we can reinvent them and draw from them as we look to the future.
So that brings me to what I found to be the most powerful part of the essay. So at one point you urge the farmer to honor their deed to the land, but also to, quote, "burn it, then bury it. If not that, then at least commit something to flame, privilege perhaps, supremacy, entitlement." So this hints at some of the previous writing you've done on the commons or on commoning. So how do you see the commons and land rights fitting into the local or sustainable food movement?
Well, thank you, Megan. I mean, the idea of the commons was once upon a time an area where people could meet their daily needs for subsistence. Now, today, when people think of the commons, they're like, ah, I know what the commons is. It's the place where the tragedy happens. And people think of the tragedy of the commons, which is a sort of thought experiment from the 1960s. And the tragedy of the commons, if you haven't heard of it before, basically the idea is that, you know, imagine we all live in a village and there's a forest around us and nobody owns this forest. And because nobody owns it, everyone will exploit it. And the tragedy is that with eyes wide open, driven by nothing more than greed and the absence of property rights, because nobody owns it, we will just be as greedy as we like and we'll chop everything down and we will saw off the last branch, knowing full well that it will destroy the world with eyes wide open. And that's tragic. So that's the tragedy of the commons. And the problem is that it never happens, not at that scale, not in the real world. People are very good at being greedy, but people are also very good at being responsible. We are social animals. And so the commons is an example of the way that many civilizations have managed land, which is to say without this idea of private property, but instead through a sort of a way of collectively deciding that we're going to govern it together and that we're going to restrain ourselves when we need to. When you have that collective governance, you think about the land differently. When you think about private property, when you start having these principles of private property, you also start to think about the land differently. And if you see yourself as the sole owner of this land, able to do with it as you will, you're going to take a very different relationship to if you see it as something that owns you. If the land is your mother, for example, then you're going to treat it very differently than if it's something that you own, like you own a can of soda.
So this gets for me at a really critical, essential piece of the conversations that we're having about food these days. So yours is a very different approach. It's a scaling up compared to a lot of the other conversations that we have. So we talk a lot about education of individuals or improving access for individuals, and that centers a lot on choice. Can you talk about the role of choice in these conversations and the power that comes from transitioning from an individual to a collective perspective?
What a lovely question. I mean, choice is, as a number of social scientists are starting to realize and demonstrate experimentally, an illusion. When you go into a supermarket, for example, you're wandering into a temple where you feel like everything is made for you. But in fact, nothing could be further from the truth. When you go into a supermarket, it's one of the most carefully curated laboratories of human experimentation that we've yet come up with. And the irony is that when you go into a supermarket, although you think everything is made for you, in fact, you have been made for everything in that supermarket. You've been transformed into a sort of a consumer that had to drive to the supermarket to get there, that had to ignore or pay scant attention to the poverty that's right outside the supermarket, that believes that a lot of the processed things that are in these boxes counts as food. But I think one of the greatest illusions about the modern food system is that it's filled with choice. And the more that we can realize that we can be happy without choice and recognize that eating locally and seasonally is a much better way of doing things, even if then we find ourselves with a little bit more kale or rutabaga than we'd like. That recognition that actually, working with the rhythm of the seasons shouldn't be a lifestyle choice, it should just be the way things are, is actually fairly liberating. Because in order for us to have the illusion of choice, to be able to have a wall of 100 different kinds of sugar confection that are, children's breakfast cereal, requires such damage to the environment and damage to ourselves, it's worth taking a step back from this idea of saying, well, all we need is individual level education and then people can go out and figure things out. I mean, I think that way of solving the problem of the food system is really to blame the victim. When we live in a world where we and our children are shaped from an early age by the advertising claims of the food industry, to be able to de-brainwash ourselves from that kind of that kind of propaganda is going to take a lot of work. And to think that we solve the problem of the food industry's lies by a little bit of intellectual self-defense is to miss the bigger problem. That actually we shouldn't be thinking of defending ourselves. We should be thinking about stopping the attacks. And that means moving away from this world of abundant consumer choice and baubles and trinkets and strange blue food, and instead corralling the food industry's power over us by thinking much more, not in terms of, well, we want this in our food rather than that, and thinking much more about, we want to control this and this and this about our food system. And if food corporations get in the way, then they don't belong in that system.
Raj Patel is a research professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas in Austin. He also contributed to Letters to a Young Farmer. Megan Betts also interviewed author and peach farmer Mas Masumoto about his essay in the collection. They're both archived at eartheats.org. Coming up, seedless watermelons have their pros and cons.
Well, I mean, they're convenient, and they're great if you're making watermelon juice or something. But I think that they taste they're a little bit less spectacular in the flavor.
Yes, we'll be making a simple watermelon juice with Daniel Orr, along with another flashier recipe. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal, food for everyone, everywhere, full menu, and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com. I'm Annie. You're with Earth Eats. June is fruit month on our little show. It was bananas last week. It's watermelon this week. We'll have a brunch recipe for fruit smothered in tequila lime syrup. Daniel doubles as a sculptor in that recipe. First up, though, watermelon, water, and mint, and a blender. That's all you'll need. So easy. Daniel first gives us a tutorial on the not-so-easy process of getting at the fruit but leaving the seeds.
So today we're using a little local watermelon. And what I'm going to do is I cut off the top and the bottom, and that way it sits stable. And then I'm going to take the peel off of it. And you just kind of follow the line. You follow right along that melon rind. And you can use the melon rind for pickling. Back in the day when they didn't have a whole lot to eat during the war and between the wars, World War I, World War II, you know, people made do with what they had, and watermelon rinds were a favorite to have alongside smoked fresh local ham and that kind of thing. And what you do is take the rind, take the peel off of it, so you're just using the white part, and then pickle it with some sugar and spices, and then you could store it, you could can it. So now you have your nude watermelon, and the seeds do grow in a circle. So if you cut that in half, you can see there's a nice center part that has no seeds. So go ahead and cut that out in a circle. And then you can just take your knife and get rid of all the little seeds. And I think that the watermelons with seeds actually taste a lot better than the seedless varieties. All right, so we've got these nice and seeded, and we're going to puree this. And if you want to, you could add a little bit of water to get the engine going. So we'll just put a little splash in here. And we're going to whiz it around. All right, easy as that. Now what we're going to do, just to make it a little more fun, is put some fresh herbs in it. So we're going to use some mint. So we're just going to chiffonade it, which means that we're going to cut it into thin little ribbons. Okay, and then I've got some frozen glasses. What we're going to do is put the mint leaves in, first. So when we pour the melon puree over the top, it will mix in. And that's all there is to it.
Cheers.
Cheers. Here's to Earth Eats.
This is the weirdest looking watermelon I've ever seen in my life. It's like a dinosaur egg.
Kind of, yeah. This is actually from our farm down in Gibson County. And we grew some watermelons, and this one was shaped perfectly to do a whale. So I'm going to show you guys how to carve a little fruit bowl out of a watermelon. Okay, so I've drawn out a little whale on here, and you can also do swans and different things. But I'm just going to kind of go around the rounded part up here in the front and start cutting around for the head. And then I'm going back towards the back of the melon and making a little swoop around there, and we're going to get started on the tail.
Were you big into carving pumpkins as a kid?
Oh, I still love carving pumpkins. Okay, and then we're just going to cut out this middle section and open it up into a punch bowl kind of shape. So we're just pulling out these big chunks of watermelon, and you can start seeing the whale take shape. There's the big tail, and now we're going to start with the face. I've got the little blowhole here at the top. Okay, and then we're going to carve out the eyes. We'll put a big smile on it. All right, so I'm just going to dice up this melon a little bit and throw some other fruit in here, and then we'll make that nice syrup. So I've also got some cantaloupe here. Got a few blackberries and a few blueberries. Okay, and the syrup is very, very simple. We're going to take a quarter cup of agave syrup, quarter cup of tequila, and I'm going to squeeze the juice of a lime. And then just to kind of give it that margarita flavor, we're going to put a pinch of salt in it. And a lot of people like a little bit of salt on top of their melon, so. Okay, we'll mix that up. I'm going to let you have a taste of this.
Okay, here we go. That tastes like a margarita.
Right?
Spot on.
So we're going to spoon this over our fruit salad.
That pickled watermelon rind, though. This was one of those things that sounded just too weird when I first heard about it. But now I see pickled watermelon rind everywhere this time of year. I put a couple recipes for it on our Twitter feed, so you can make the juice and the watermelon whale with our recipes, and then go to twitter.com/EarthEats to learn how to process the rind. You'll see beautiful pictures on eartheats.org. Many of those are snapped by Aobon Binder. Our news coverage is with Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, and Taylor Killo. Thanks also to Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington Restaurant, Indiana University's Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Earth Eats executive producer is John Bailey. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb. Taste matters, your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. Of course, it's always great to have you here. Thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan.